From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. 3 years ago, a leaked draft from the U.S. Supreme Court set into motion an overhaul of the country's abortion laws and marked a new era in the debate over reproductive rights. Since Roe v. Wade has been overturned, the right to legally terminate a pregnancy is in the hands of states and can range from a complete ban, including rape or incest, or even when the life of the mother is in danger, to places like California, which codified the right to abortion in the state constitution following the Dobbs decision. A new book argues that simply undoing Roe has never been the endpoint for the anti-abortion movement, but that for decades, the larger goal has been to secure fetal personhood under the U.S. Constitution, which could make abortion laws like California's unconstitutional, as well as dramatically change regulations on in vitro fertilization or IVF. Mary Ziegler is a Martin Luther King professor of law at UC Davis and is considered a leading expert on abortion history in the country. She joins us to discuss her new book, Personhood, The New Civil War Over Reproduction. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So it's been almost 3 years to the day since that draft leak from Politico. I'm sure in the years since you have anticipated some or even much of what has unfolded. But what has struck you most in the initial years since Roe was overturned?
Well, I think what I've been struck by is in some ways how quickly everything has moved and how I think people have been lulled into, in some ways, kind of a false sense of security. I think we've seen some holding fire from conservatives, right? We've just begun to see these kinds of cross-border lawsuits targeting people in places like California. We've just begun to see a push for fetal personhood. And I think that that manifested for a lot of people in believing that the status quo was kind of forever, right? I think a lot of people didn't see this as a major issue in 2024 in the election, or fewer people than I would have expected. And I think in part that's because we're really just seeing the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. Well, let's unpack that idea of fetal personhood, because it isn't necessarily a fixed definition. It can mean something different depending on who you're talking to, the context of a conversation, even a field of study, as you laid out. It could be if you're talking to someone in the legal profession, science, philosophy, religion. How have you come to understand it?
Well, the sense I mean fetal personhood in the book, and I think the sense that we see the most often in U.S. politics, is really a claim about the law and about the Constitution, right? So the two kind of main components, I guess, the two common denominators are a belief that from the moment an egg is fertilized, there's a separate, unique individual biologically, and that that individual has constitutional rights. After that, though, there's a lot of disagreement about what it means, right? So what are those constitutional rights? How do we enforce those constitutional rights? And it turns out that that has produced a lot of infighting, both within the anti-abortion movement, and I think sometimes for other Americans, too, who may think life in the womb has value and then sort of part ways from the anti-abortion movement when it comes to criminalizing abortion or even restricting IVF.
Yeah. How does this relate to the 14th Amendment? Because that's what you really hone in on as well. And the 14th Amendment is, you know, determines who is a citizen and afforded due process, equal protection under the law. How does this relate to fetal personhood?
Well, so the anti-abortion movement has seized on the fact that parts of the 14th Amendment use the word citizen, right? When we're thinking about the fight over birthright citizenship now, that part of the 14th Amendment uses that word. The Due Process and Equal Protection Clause, which give us liberty and equality, use the word person. And anti-abortion advocates argue that that was a deliberate choice and that the word person applies from the moment of fertilization, right? So those rights, unlike the rights that would be afforded to citizens, apply the moment an egg is fertilized. So it's that particular type of personhood that we're talking about, constitutional personhood, 14th Amendment personhood.
And so if, hypothetically, if that was upheld, that could actually upend states like California, which have codified the right to an abortion in its state constitution.
That's absolutely kind of the end game here, right? So if you are the anti-abortion movement, you are absolutely not okay with the idea that each state can make its own decision. Abortion opponents will often, you know, refer to the Civil War, right? And the idea of a house divided against itself cannot stand. The idea that you can't have half the nation recognizing abortion rights and half the nation recognizing fetal rights. So their argument is that liberal laws like California's on abortion or on IVF or potentially even on contraception would violate the federal rights under the 14th Amendment of a fetus or embryo. Again, I don't know if that follows, right? Because personhood is this moving target. You could argue even if a fetus or embryo is a rights holder, that doesn't follow. We've seen other nations recognize rights in fetuses or embryos or unborn children and not draw that conclusion. But that's what abortion opponents today are driving at.
One of the arguments for those who supported Roe versus Wade being overturned, they support the Dobbs decision, was that it should be kicked down to states. And so this argument for fetal personhood, saying that, no, it shouldn't be kicked down to states, it should just be a federal right to protect the right of a fetus. How widespread is support for that idea among those who are against abortion?
I would say virtually universal. There's disagreement about how to pursue it, but there's almost no disagreement about that being the end game. So the argument that Roe was anti-democratic and that each state should be left to go its own way was absolutely a means to an end. It was not the movement's, this is, after all, right, to hear people in the movement tell it is a right to life movement, right? They will say, it is a movement about human rights. They don't say it's a movement about preserving democracy or states' rights. So that was just a way station on the road to something much bigger. And that's really why I wanted to write the book. I think people were thinking that the proponents of fetal personhood were some sort of small fringe element of the anti-abortion movement, when in fact, I think there is no daylight between the fetal personhood movement and the anti-abortion movement. I think they are one and the same.
And this obviously goes beyond the right to terminate a pregnancy. It can also shape fertility procedures like IVF. What would the recognition of fetal personhood mean for IVF?
So at least as we currently understand fetal personhood, or at least as the anti-abortion movement has defined it, the most obvious change would be that IVF could no longer involve the creation and cryopreservation of additional embryos. So for a lot of families treating infertility, they create more embryos than they're planning to implant in a single pregnancy, both to maximize the odds that they can have successful pregnancy in that instance and later if they want potentially additional children, and also to reduce cost. Because IVF as it stands is often prohibitively expensive for a lot of American families. So if you view an embryo as a person, indefinitely storing that embryo is problematic, destroying that embryo is problematic. So the proposal that abortion opponents have put on the table is that you could only implant and create one embryo at a time, which would radically change IVF, make it much less effective and much more expensive. There are some proponents of fetal personhood who don't think IVF is redeemable, even with these kinds of regulations. But I think that there's a consensus that IVF, as we know it, would have to radically change, if not kind of go away altogether.
Given the political climate, the current administration with the Trump administration, and President Trump, of course, was a strong ally for pro-life or anti-abortion rights, what are the odds of this moving forward, do you think?
Well, I think the answer really depends on judges. So we have not seen much of a sign that the Trump administration wants to move quickly on anything related to abortion or reproductive rights. And that stands in sharp contrast to what the Trump administration is doing on virtually everything else, right? Like deliberation and slowness are not the hallmarks of the Trump administration, except on abortion. So obviously that could change. But what we have seen is a willingness on the part of the Trump administration to continue nominating the kinds of judges that the pro-life or anti-abortion movement prefers. And those judges will be more likely to at least give a hearing to these arguments about 14th Amendment personhood. And I think that would suit the Trump administration, because while I don't think Trump wants to be the one who has his fingerprints on dramatic changes in abortion policy, he's also aligned with social movements that expect and demand those changes. So I think as far as fetal personhood is concerned, we're more likely to see short-term changes from state Supreme Courts and state legislatures, while the groundwork for a potentially bigger change is being laid in the changing composition of our federal courts.
Okay, so the political will, at least from the Trump administration, perhaps may not be as there as it was during his first administration. Do you think the public interest has waned since the Dobbs decision?
Yeah, I think we've seen To some degree, before Dobbs, we saw that most Americans supported the idea of abortion rights. And since Dobbs came down, those numbers have moved only further in that direction, right? So there's even more support for abortion rights than there was before 2022. So support for fetal personhood is even lower, right? Fetal personhood would be a significant step further than we've already taken when it comes to restricting reproductive rights, and particularly for kind of eliminating the safety valves that apply not only for people who live in states like California, but also people who can travel to states like California or buy medication from states like California. So there's no reason to think that voters would want fetal personhood. And that's precisely why it's an argument being made about the 14th Amendment. It's an argument being directed to judges who may be easier to convince than voters.
Is there an incremental step or goal that this movement is making, maybe not going as far as fetal personhood and getting it recognized under the 14th Amendment, but there's something that still advances where they would like this to go?
Absolutely. There's sort of two, I would say, two parallel incremental strategies. One is to get fetal personhood recognized in isolated ways in discrete laws. So we've seen a number of leading anti-abortion groups sign on to this, what they call the new North Star strategy, where there are laws on, for example, giving people child support while they're pregnant, or allowing people to sue for wrongful death the moment they become pregnant for the death of an unborn child, or laws regulating how embryos are stored, all of in the name of kind of fetal rights in one discrete area that isn't the Constitution. And the idea is enough of those laws could pile up that the anti-abortion movement could return to the US Supreme Court and say, look, there's this tidal wave of conservative support for this idea that you can't ignore. At the same time, I think we're seeing efforts to shut down access to abortion and IVF immediately that aren't done in the name of fetal personhood, whether that's state-inspired bills to shut down access to abortion pills, which we're seeing in places like Texas, efforts to convince the Trump administration to tighten restrictions on mifepristone, which is a pill used in most abortions in the United States, including California, efforts to turn the Comstock Act, which is an obscenity law, into an abortion ban. So there are lots of sort of stopgap solutions that are gaining support too. Fetal personhood is kind of like the new great white whale for the anti-abortion movement, right? If taking down Roe v. Wade is what defined the past 50 years of American law and life when it came to reproduction, this is the next big thing. So it may not be happening imminently. It may not be the next fight you see just ending in our courts, but it's what's animating almost everything else that's going on the conservative side.
Yeah, and that is why you're a leading expert when it comes to looking at the history of this. As a law student, even a professor, you could have gone in a lot of directions in your career. Why did you become so dedicated to abortion history and reproduction?
Well, it was actually in part because there was just a gap in what people knew. So I was a law student myself. I was taking a legal history course, and we were reading books sort of about, can law change the world, right, or not? And I kept expecting to read a book about Roe, because the conventional story was that Roe had produced backlash. It had all these undesired, unintended consequences. And we didn't read the book. So I went to office hours and asked my professor, you know, hey, what's up? Like, why did I thought it was a good sort of student. I didn't get it. And he said, well, there really isn't much that's been written about that. It's kind of understudied. So I just became really curious because I thought it was important. So I started studying it on my own in law school, and some of that research became the research for my first book. So it's something I care about personally, but it's also just something I felt that there was a huge hole in our knowledge, because it's something people were passionate about advocating for in terms of what ought to happen, so much so that sometimes they didn't know why we had gotten where we are today.
And that passion of yours goes beyond academia, even the classroom. I was looking on Reddit and you had an active thread of engagement with people online. What does this add to having this type of relationship and connecting the public to your work in this way?
Well, I think it's important for people to understand the history in this particular space, especially because it reminds us that if we're not happy with the status quo, this was not always the way things are. I think sometimes if you look at the past, you see kind of roads not taken and possibilities that seem kind of really far-fetched now, but that were once considered really realistic. So I think sometimes engaging with the public is a way of giving people hope that things that seem entrenched and stalemated and hopeless now didn't always seem that way, and that there may be, for that reason, ways beyond where we are now.
Mary, thank you so much for joining us. Professor Ziegler.
Mary is totally fine, and anytime I'm happy to come. Thanks.
Mary Ziegler is a Martin Luther King Professor of Law at UC Davis and is considered a leading expert on abortion history in the U.S., discussing her new book, Personhood, The New Civil War Over Reproduction. Up next, we'll speak with the Parkinson's disease advocate about his diagnosis ahead of an awareness walk in Sacramento this Saturday. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio, where facts matter and stories inspire. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.